Hello, this is Tamiko Faison, your host of Therapy Entrepreneurs and Leaders of Color, a podcast dedicated to therapy entrepreneurs and leaders of color who are leading and inspiring in their space. The purpose of this podcast is to inspire therapists, particularly therapists of color, by sharing the accomplishments of therapy entrepreneurs and leaders of color, as well as to support them in their roles. Today, our guest is Dr. Shirley Wells, and I am so excited. She is the chair and a full professor in the Department of Occupational Therapy at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. She was recognized as one of the 100 influential people in occupational therapy by the American Occupational Therapy Association, Incorporated. She is among other leaders and innovators, living or deceased in the OT profession, who have significantly advanced or revolutionized the field and were selected among hundreds of nominees to be honored by AOTA during OT's centennial year celebration. She is an advocate for diversity. She has groundbreaking books on culture and occupational therapy, scholarly articles related to culture and health, her role as a cultural liaison for AOTA, including calling for a diverse and inclusive membership, non-discrimination, and use of gender-neutral language in AOTA documents. And I love this quote by one of her colleagues. He says, "Her passion and driving forces made a difference during a time of indifference and brought about what now has become a clear path toward inclusion of social justice and understanding of the client as a person who must be understood from their perspective based on their values, morals, and cultural uniqueness." Dr. Wells, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I am so glad to have you and glad that we worked some things out this morning. So I read your bio, and I want you to just tell me a little about yourself and how you became interested in OT in your own words.
Well, I really did not know much about OT. I'm what they call one of those latecomers to the profession. I had already gone to college and had a bachelor's degree, and I was still trying to figure out what I was going to do. My brother at the time started medical school, and he met a couple of OTs on the university where he was doing his medical training. So he calls me up and said, "Did you know there's a profession that does all of that craft stuff that you do? And you can actually get paid for it." And I'm like, "Oh, I can?" So, and of course, we didn't have internet and stuff then. So he went and checked out a book from the library, mind you, at his university, sent it to me so I could read up on OT, and said, "Oh, this sounds pretty good," because I was either going to do that, I was thinking about becoming a forest ranger. All right, here's my two options. So let me get a little bit more information. And I wrote AOTA at the time and got some information from them. And it was only two programs in the state of Texas at that time: University of Texas Medical Branch and Texas Women University. So I said, "This sounds like something fun of what I want to do." So I applied to the University of Texas Medical Branch and went down for the interview. And I remember the guy said, "What if you don't get accepted into the program?" Because believe it or not, it was competitive then to get into the program. I said, "Well, I got a backup plan. I'm either going to be a forest ranger, I'm going to go back and get my master's degree in psychology or something." And he fell out laughing. He said, "We never get folks in here with a backup plan." And at this point, I still had not seen an OT. All I have done is read about OT. I still had no idea hands-on what they actually did, other than this sounds like fun. And believe it or not, I got accepted. This was like in the fall where the program started that summer, and it's been OT ever since then.
Wow. So your brother, he knew you well enough to know this would be a good fit.
Yes.
For your personality.
Yes, definitely.
And it's been OT ever since. And I mean, you have just accomplished so much in your career. I was reading some more about your bio before we got started, and you've been both an entrepreneur and a leader. Can you talk about your previous roles and your current roles as both an entrepreneur and a leader in occupational therapy?
In terms of entrepreneur, yes, I had my own practice here for a while before I went back into teaching full time. But throughout my career, I've always done consulting.
Okay.
Even though I maintain a full time job position, there were always people saying, I need an OT. Can you help? So I started doing kind of my own private practice on the side and have always, and I continue to do that. It's still something that I do. I'm just now even more selective in terms of who I take on. But it has always been a part of me and what I feel my role is as an OT, because there's so many people who need so much help. And it's kind of hard to say no. And I know I'm working on it.
Yes.
And especially when you hear the stories and you see them trying, I'm like, then I've got to do something. I have to figure out a way to help them. And they don't always have insurance or a lot of money. They don't even realize they even need the help. Until they, as in, I know this person, it took a lot of them to even come forward. So that's the least I can do. For me, OT has never been about making money. As long as I make enough to pay my bills and buy a few luxury items, as I say, only a few of them, need all of them, it's okay. I kind of say I made that decision long time ago when I decided I wanted to do OT in public health. I said, because of what I want, I'm here to help anyone any way that I can within reason. I'm not going to do anything illegal, but anything that's in reason, and especially growing up in the projects and having and seeing people who need things and just need minor help, I said, this is a part of who I am. This is some of the traits and stuff I learned from my mother. I can't sit here and pretend they do not exist. So I have to do this as much as I can. So I'm still doing that. Just got a text yesterday from the same brother who is now in a physician. And his new things that he wants to do. And he just said, oh, have you thought about doing an occupational medicine? I'm hollering, where is this coming from? And I said, well, are you thinking about doing this? And I'm texting, yeah, let's talk this weekend. And I'm like, where can I fit this in?
Wow.
I don't want to sit here. I said, you know I'm busy over here. And I have my nonprofit group that I'm a part of. How, where am I supposed to fit this in? You keep coming up with stuff, and he's always done this. And he, because he truly understands what OT is about. And he's saying, as long as I got an OT, I don't need anybody else. Yeah, but you're killing me. Because he has a tendency to volunteer me, give my services away. I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. And he gets, and when he has these new ideas, because then patients are coming to him, and he said, oh yeah, we can deal with that. I got an OT. I'll talk to her. I got my private calls. And I do. I get that. He'll say, oh, and he'll give my number. I'll call her. She'll tell you. And I'm like, why do you do this?
Such an advocate for OT. If we could just replicate that with other physicians around the world.
Yes.
Have that understanding of our value and the benefit that we bring in our service provision. It's not as well known in some non-traditional settings.
Yes, he truly understands OT and a big advocate for what we do, and telling even his other colleagues, hey, if you hire an OT, you don't need to hire anybody else. They can do it all. Mm. That works for me.
Yes.
So you
mentioned growing up in the projects and seeing certain needs growing up, and now that being part of your philosophy, that you still see things and you can't deny it, which made me think of just servant, you know, being a servant leader. Sounds like that's what you truly are. And yes. understanding that as a servant leader, the money always follows. The money is not the priority, but you'll be provided for if you're truly serving. Can you speak to that also in your other leadership roles?
Yes. In terms of not only part of being service is making sure things are fair and that people have the opportunity. We're not there. I don't think I'm there to give you a ride or to make it easy, but you are entitled to have the opportunity to give the shot. And if you make it, fine. And if you don't, it's not because of anything that was not available. And growing up during the time that I did and when it was still a lot of segregation and stuff, we just didn't have the opportunity. So I'm a big proponent of making sure people have the opportunity to make the choices that they want, to do the things that they want to do, and then it is up to them. So that's where the service and the fairness, because even when I was an OT student, I was doing that then, didn't realize at the time this was going to become a lifelong pursuit because I didn't plan on it. But in our program, I started to see certain students was getting advantages over the others. And I'm like, wait. And I'm sitting in the middle of the class. We got to discuss this. Did you not say the rule was we could not come in on someone else's lap time? Why is it these students are getting a chance to do this and the rest of us are not getting a chance to do this? And all of a sudden they looked at me and I'm like, I just want to make sure this is a fair playing ground. If we all have the same opportunity, that's all I'm asking. Is it open for everyone or only certain people? They started changing their rules and stuff and saying, oh my God, we've never had someone here to question. I said, well, I'm not questioning what you're doing. I'm just questioning the fairness of it. Mm. Because if we all can get this extra, then I want the extra too. Yeah. I am working just as hard, just make sure I have the same shot. And that's where a lot of my pursuit come from, is making sure people have the opportunity to do what they want. And if they make it, fun, and if they don't, no guarantee, but you are entitled of having the opportunity to do that.
So you felt comfortable speaking up and advocating for yourself and minorities, which just speaks to the importance of having diversity in settings.
Yeah, because at the time in that program, I was the only African American and they had three Hispanics. We were the diversity of the class.
Yeah, and would you say that has changed much since?
It depends on the program and where your program is located, but not a whole lot. Mm-hmm. It is slowly changing. The program I'm in, we are 90% Hispanic.
Oh, wow.
Yes. Yes. As a matter of fact, I have been doing some programming and recruiting and stuff. We're trying to recruit. When I mentioned minority, folks laugh at me. I said, I'm talking about African-American, Asian, and white. Anyhow, you do not understand. If I get one or two white in my program, that's diversity.
Understanding the true definition of diversity, because I think sometimes people just think solely ethnic minorities, and it just depends on the program and the demographics of that program. And I applaud you for recognizing that. So our profession, the OT profession, is in about 4-6% persons of color. How has that impacted you? And is that your understanding of the current percentage?
Currently, but that's still from when I started, it's still an increase. Not a lot, but that is an increase, because when I came along, it was even less.
Mm. So how has that impacted your roles, if at all? If you want to, can you talk a little about that with that low percentage?
In terms of the role, is making sure, because one of the things that I did learn too is going back and thinking how I had already gone to college and did a lot of things before I even heard or even knew that occupational therapy existed. So my thing and what I always advocate is that, first of all, we're talking about groups who don't even know that this field exists. So we're not even in their train of thoughts in terms of picking off a career choice. Because they don't know who we are. They don't know what we have to offer. I said, OTs are not in my community. They were not at my health centers. So therefore, how am I supposed to see that? How am I even supposed to know? All we heard in terms of medicine was nurse or physician.
Okay.
Not the other ally health. So I've always keep saying what we need to do is to make sure that they know that this is even a field that is an option to them. And part of the stuff that we are doing as part of our recruitment here, we go and recruit at HBCUs. Just in working with their counselors and saying, here is occupational therapy. Please, we will come on your campus and talk to your students ourselves so that they know this is a program. And I had a grant from the state of Texas, and we were also able to bring some of these students to iCampus here because, again, folks keep thinking, oh, my God, an Hispanic program on the border. What do you mean trying to recruit African-Americans? That's our goal for the program. I've got to increase the number of African-Americans in my program. Program have been here for almost 20 years, and we've only had 2 African-Americans in it. What's wrong with this picture? So that's when we started talking to these HBCUs, and we're only talking to the ones in the state of Texas, most of them had no idea what occupational therapy was. So I said, this is part of the problem. We are not even on their radar. So therefore, we never enter their consciousness. Is this a choice or a field that is good for me? Because I program here and we have increased the numbers of OT in the community, we have more students here applying to our program because all of a sudden, everybody knows what it is. And so we know that will make a difference. If we can get into these other minority communities, and we are now starting to see the change because we've been doing this for about four years now. I'm seeing an increase of number of African Americans applying to us.
That's great. So that was going to be another question I was going to ask. What advice do you give to OT programs that are trying to increase their diversity? It sounds like you're very proactive. You're going to these HBCUs. It sounds like it's part of your strategic plan to increase the number of African-American students in the program. What other things are you doing, and what advice would you give to program directors who have this goal of increasing the diversity in the program, but not necessarily knowing the action steps to get there?
Well, first of all, the old recruitment stuff is not going to work. They need to abandon all of that. As a matter of fact, as I'm doing a presentation even for Asher next week on this and our whole recruitment plan. I have submitted this proposal to AOTA for the past year and a half, and every time they was not accepted. Now, fine. Asher wants to hear from us. We are going to go present it, because my colleague from the communication disorder program, because we did this program together, we're going to and present it to them. And it's a three-pronged component to it. One of them is bringing the students and having an avenue for the students to come down to our campus to really see the possibility, because for us, we also have an additional issue that folks don't know about our university. Because, and or they think it's not safe because we're located on the border here. So we know we have to get folks to come down here to see it, which is always very impressive. The students said, we had no idea all of this was here, and you guys have this big program and everything else. So, and we had everyone to come and talk to them about going through the program, financial aid, what is it like, because we will bring them down for 3 days. and they will actually stay on campus and everything else. And we had a lot of activities and things, and everyone talking to them and housing and whatever to say, this is what we have to offer if you want to come here for our graduate program. The second prong is actually working with the counselors at these schools, giving them information. And we actually send one of my faculty or advisor actually go to their campus, and we do advising and things on their campus. We're not necessarily totally dependent on the counselors at that university to do it. We said, no, we will come and do it ourselves. Set up, and we then start to set up communication between those students and our students before they even become our student. So they will start to do, and we're doing that through Skype and Zoom, having that interaction between them and our student. And these are students who are still trying to decide whether or not they're going to apply. That's fine. That's okay, as long as you're thinking about it and if you want more information. The other strong component to our plan is community support. Because of where we are, we know, and people assume, that there is not an African-American community here in the Valley, but it is. It's not a large one, but it is a very strong community of entrepreneurs, other professionals, and everything else. So I partner with a lot of them, and they participate when the student is on campus. We, even once the student comes on campus, they are assigned a community family that they then can become a part of that family, and their family and those individuals there are to help them integrate and find the things and services that they need, someone they can talk to outside of the program. Mm-hmm. And they are automatically matched up from the very beginning. They come to the orientation. Here it is. Here is your, and for some of the parents, it makes them feel better too. No, that's okay. We got them connected. Here's all the services. We will help them in finding anything that they need, because we know they still have to be comfortable socially. So it's not always just addressing their academic issues, which is what we do for our whole program across the board anyway, but we know they need that social connection.
Yes.
So we try to connect them to the community, and our community people love it. Yes, we're there. And see, all of this stuff is totally volunteer. We don't pay these people, anyone, for this. But because they are committed like we are, and we love living here, let's help make these students comfortable, because we all agree the goal is to get them to be professionals.
What innovative ways of recruitment, and not just recruitment, retention, understanding that once you get them there, there are other steps that need to take place to ensure that they're comfortable socially. Mm-hmm. I would love to hear that presentation at AOTA at some point in the future. So I hope it continues to be submitted and at some point accepted. That is just, it's awesome to hear that you're bringing in the community to help support these students of color.
Yeah, our number of, because then the other thing we said, if they don't apply, they have no chance. So our goal was not necessarily even to admit them, but is that I need to increase the number of applicants. If they don't apply, they have no chance of getting in.
Right.
And so, and that's what we tell them. We're not promising you going to get in, but you have to apply. And we have seen the past 2 years, and it's been 3 years every year, the number of applicants from both not only Hispanics, but also because recently we've been working with some of the Asian students who are not in the area from outside of, I mean, from other parts of the state, are now coming in. And applying, and said, because we've heard about your program. And even the white students that come in, we ask, why are you here? We heard that this is what your program is about. So the word is getting out there, and that you're looking for this, you do the one-on-one. And they said, it's because of that one-on-one kind of connection, family connection that you guys have here. I said, yeah, once you're here, you're one of our family members. We will deal with every issues. And of course, then when they come in and the white parents come in, I have to always, you know, don't worry about it. She will be taken care of. And if you have any question, call me anytime, because mm-hmm. this is going to be a culture shock for her too. And yes. we're here to help her deal with that, just like anyone else. This is a different Hispanic environment. So mm-hmm. all of you guys are coming into a new culture. We are here to help any student who are not from this area. Mm-hmm. And we're getting quite a few out-of-state students and everything else. And so for us, it's still what we have to address. And most of the time, these students end up staying here.
After graduation, they make it their home. So they really do feel like they have become part of the community, which shows that all your strategies are effective. You have outcomes.
Yes.
proving that the process works.
Yes. The process definitely worked. And now we are finally getting back to the whole component about how then do we get this information to the communities, which is the other part of our recruitment plan. Now, how then are we going to get information and start educating these minority communities that here is a profession?
Mm-hmm.
Think about it.
Yes.
It is an option. This is the reward. You know, you don't have to just go to medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make a good living off of this and that kind of stuff. So, that is a little bit harder for us because we are so far away from those communities, but we're still dealing with that. We work with the Black sororities and fraternities. We have a couple of them that we are in communication. We send information to them. We ask them to talk to their members and whatever. And we've gotten some students that I heard about this at my sorority meeting. Thank you. Now let us tell you about our program.
Yes. Wow. Awesome. Awesome. Can I talk a little bit about socioeconomic status and diversity in the profession with that? I know we're talking about people of color, but I think that you mentioned, you know, being from the projects and then going into a space where not only is it majority our profession white female, but also more middle class. How was that for you coming from a lower socioeconomic background? And do you address that with in your program, students who may be coming from lower SES status?
Oh, the majority of our students are.
Okay.
Yeah, we are in terms of the state of Texas, we are definitely, I would say, when I was just had those data and presented them, the majority of families live below the poverty level.
Okay.
So that is our student body.
Okay.
As a whole, we don't have very few individuals that are in that high socioeconomic level coming in. And that's one of the things we really push for too, because we know if we can move them to a professional level, not only is their economic level is going to change, but also the economic level of their families.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at this, we are improving families. We are not just improving the lives of the individual. We are changing a whole community in terms of financial stability and support.
Yes.
Because that's part of the culture and the way it is here, because we know they all contribute to get that student through the program. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are first-time students. So when I sit and talk to them, said, I totally understand because I was there too. First time in the family to actually part of that first generation of our family to actually go to college and to move things. Just had an example the other day, and I was talking to my brother once, a medical student, who is a physician. I had a student that we had admitted, but somehow she was not able to get the funds to pay for the very first semester. And I remember asking her, I said, well, is there anybody else in your family that can help you or that will come up with the money to pay the tuition? And she looked at me and she said, no. When she said that, Ahala, I know how that feels.
And
I was at that point, and there are folks that can you get money from someone else in your family? And I'm hollering, No,
we aren't.
Understand where our family's coming from. The fact that they can't even send me money to eat on. And you're talking about me coming up with thousands of dollars to pay for tuition.
Yes.
It is not going to happen. And so I'm hot. It just brought it back to me. Yes. I know how she feels because that's where I started. That's the environment I came from too. My mother worked as a maid. My father worked as a janitor. It was six of us. You couldn't call aunts and uncles, just do not have that kind of money because they didn't have those kind of jobs. So no, I can't go back and ask someone else in my family to help me because it is not fair. But then turning around and my great niece, who is now is in college and whatever, and she's calling me and saying, okay, I want to do this. I need some extra money. For her education, that's the difference. Cause now I can help her.
Yes.
I have that kind of fun sitting there then seeing, I got to get the dorm paid. How much, a couple of thousand dollars. Who do I send it to?
That's great.
To show that, yes, we're changing the family because of we were able to get here. I can now help the next generation of my family and saying, yeah, you in trouble. This is what you need. I can come up with that sum of money on a large scale, especially between me and your brother and my other brother. Yes. We are not all professionals. We can come up to help them so that they will not have to sit there and saying, I got to wait. I got to postpone. I've got to figure something else out.
Right.
And this is what we're doing. I said, if we can do it, then why can't we change it for these students? We have to start somewhere. So what I ended up telling the student, okay, since you can, I said, I tell you what, we will just defer your admission a year. You're automatically included in the next class. Spend this next year, do whatever you have to do. Your spot in that next class is already secured. So you don't have to worry about that. You now know you will have this opportunity. So you've got a year working with your family and all the other paperwork, and we'll tell you when the call is and making sure the university, when you have to get that financial aid and all this stuff in. Figure it out. Make a plan. You will have that opportunity to pursue your dream. And that's all we want to do is give them the opportunity.
Yeah, I hear that as a reoccurring theme. And it's not that you're just changing things in your family, you're changing things in the family of others. And it's because you really can relate. I come from a similar background, first generation college graduate. My mom also cleaned houses, and I was having a conversation with another minority graduate, and we were sort of laughing at that. The question when people ask, "Is there anybody else that can help you?" and we're going, "We're taking our financial aid money and we're sending it back to them.
Yes.
Like they're expecting us to help them. Like how can we? No, they think we made it once we were at college, and they want us to help them. So no, we cannot ask them for money. But
it's strange when your white colleagues don't get that either, and they think you have this and you can call on the family member. No, you don't. And I passed it. Oh, but you're this. I said, yes, I may be this now, but you have no idea where I come from. Mm-hmm. That's not the world, your world. I said, and that's me. The rest of my family is still there. People that I know is still there. Our whole community. Operate that way.
Yeah, and that makes a difference in understanding occupational justice, social justice, and
yes.
Occupational participation. So I know in OT programs, when you're discussing occupational participation, a person who's from a lower SES background can bring just more diversity of thought about access in those conversations if they've experienced that. Yes. Yeah, so I really appreciate
it. And that has no color to it when you're talking about socioeconomic.
That's
right. There is no color line. It does not matter. They're all coming with the same story.
Mm-hmm. That's very true.
So we just, okay. And our program right now in terms of our tuition and stuff, even for out-of-state students, it's, we are a very reasonable cost factor. Mm-hmm. And as a university, we try to keep it low because we know who our population is. Mm-hmm. And we want to make sure that higher education is affordable.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, yes, our students are graduating with a debt factor of only maybe $20,000 to $40,000.
That is great. That is great because that's not even the tuition for like a semester at some university. So taking that into consideration and then having options, mm-hmm. financial support options, including, like you said, deferring for a year and coming up with a plan. I've not heard of that being an option in the past. So yeah. Again, another innovative way to help support people who may have financial hardship. What advice would you give to a therapist of color who's seeking to go into the profession and wants to become a leader or an entrepreneur?
The major advice I would give them, take advantage of any opportunity that comes along, even if you don't even understand what they're asking you to do. You will learn something out of it. You will meet people out of it. It will help you grow. Mm-hmm. As that opportunity may not come again. I did not plan my track and because I had no idea it was even possible. But then my mentors, who do not have to be of the same color, thing, and they, none of them were, because most of my career, I've always been the only Black. I don't know what it's like to work with her. Even where I am now, I'm still the only Black. Hey. But they're people, if they care about you and your career and development, they are going to give you their best advice. And there are some great OTs who are out there to help you.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to them. Do not look at them in terms of color, but in terms of the advice that they're giving you. The opportunities that they can open for you, because a lot of stuff, I remember I had one colleague, one mentor came up. She said, oh, for the very first article writing that I started to do, she said, oh, by the way, I gave your name that you're going to write an article, my first minority article on women. What? I did not submit for that. She told them. And then she just came back and told me that I was going to write it. What am I? She said, you talk about it all the time. You need to start putting it on paper. Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, I gave your name to be on that committee. You talk about it all the time. You keep asking me all these questions. It is time for you to be there. We would go to conferences and stuff and start. And she started introducing me to different people within the profession. You need to know this person. Hey, this is one of my new faculty. She's got the same interests in that kind of stuff. And it's like, listen to them. Listen to the advice that they give you. And they will create these opportunities for you. And then take advantage of it. Don't worry about who's it coming from or whatever. Listen, if you trust that person and you trust their advice, listen to them and take it. I still listen to both. What do you think of Arbiter? I still have Arbiter. The same individuals, I'm still talking to them. At the Education Summit, the speaker they had, who is now a president of a university, we all met up because she was one of my early mentors and we were just catching up with her. Oh my God, look at where we are now. Remember when we started? And I said, yeah, you talked me into coming into teaching. And I remember these discussions. And she said, yeah, it's been a long time. I said, but if you had not told me to do that, I would not be here. She said, nor the information I got from you, because then you realize it's a two-way thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're actually listening to you too. And saying, well, you started asking me these questions and challenging me. So I knew I had to do something different. You know, and there's three of us there all together. Well, oh my God, we have come such a long way in terms of careers. And we still, she said, still email me. You know, I'm still there behind you. I know you still got my back. She said, especially when you're ready to move to the next level and being like a dean and a president. And I don't want to go that far. I'm going to retire before then. Oh, I do not want the headache of a university president. No.
Well, you look, Dr. Wells, incredibly young, and you're talking about retirement. I'm looking at you. I'm like, you look incredibly young.
Yeah. Retirement is, I'm planning, I always plan early. I'm planning down the road. I'm planning retirement.
I hear you. That was great advice, you know, understanding the importance of mentorship and those relationships, and also understanding that it's a two-way street. It's not you just sit and get advice from someone, but you're listening and then you're following through. With that advice. So what are your favorite occupations? What do you like to do?
Other than work?
Yes, other than work.
I take that back, because work to me is not work. Work is all stuff that I like to do. But in my other free time is I am a co-founder of an animal rescue group. It's Brownsville Animal Defense, and we have now been in existence. We're a nonprofit group for 10 years, in which we totally work on getting rescuing dogs off the street from the shelter, getting them adopted, working with terms of service animals, educating our community on the importance that animals can play in terms of health and wellness, sit on the advisory board for the city animal shelter. And our long-term plan, even with them, is to, because of my public health component, we really want to make this existent. We have several programs that we're working on that I've just started. One is Senior for Senior Dogs, getting our seniors to adopt senior dogs, and we have events just for them. And special events and stuff for the animals and their pet and their pet parents, as we call them. Our students are also involved in all of this, especially as it relates to how then can a community use rescue dogs for mental health? Yes.
Okay.
Working with vets as in terms of making sure that the community understand the difference between a service animal and a companion animal and an emotional support animal. People think they are the same. They are totally different. But there is a place for all three of them within the community. We have a lot of dogs at the shelter that are looking for homes that will meet those categories and that just need to be placed that can improve the health of a family or an individual. Kids with disability, kids with autism, the elderly as they're aging, to get them out the house, using them to promote exercise and wellness. It's like the animal is more than I using them as a modality, but also using them as a companion.
Mm. Do you have a dog?
Yes, I'm down to three now.
Okay.
No, down to one. I had three. I'm down to one. Because the other one, due to old age and stuff and whatever. As a matter of fact, the one I have is the mascot for the department. I have to take her. Students want her there every day. So she goes to work every day, and her job is to hang out with the students. She sits in the classroom, you know, run. She has total run of the building when we are there. Everybody knows who she is. And I just did a presentation to the college advisory board, which, of course, I open it up with her saying, welcome to the occupational therapy department. You know, like, yeah, she's it. The students now worry about her more than I do, because even when we had our orientation, she's there running around meeting the new parents and the new students to say, welcome. I'm here. I'm a part of all of this. Because the student loves it, you know, especially when they are under stress doing finance, it's just great to have her here.
Yeah, I love it. I'm looking at
that's the purpose. So
yeah,
it doesn't always have to be a service dog, which they are for different purposes, but people need to know that there is a connection. And as OTs, that's part of improving their health. Physically and mentally.
I'm
still doing OT. Okay, so I'm always doing OT. So you call a downtime?
Still OT.
I'm still OT because
still OT.
I can take OT into everything that I do.
It's such a great profession.
Yeah, but they're just fun things, and I do them because I love them. So I don't really see it as a hobby. This is just part of who I am because I've made OT a part of my life every day.
I love it.
Separate it out.
I love it. What's next for you, and how can we support you in those goals and your future plans?
I'm not, because everybody keep asking me that too. What's next? And I can't. Retirement? Retirement? I said, like I plan for everything else, I got to plan for retirement. And I said, but what you going to do? I said, oh, don't worry. I've got plenty of stuff that's already sitting here. And then, of course, like my brother sending me this text yesterday, I'm hollering, no, I don't need any more projects. I need to learn how to enjoy and relax and do leisure. Which I don't know if that may be possible because it's like, but as an OT, I'm supposed to be busy all the time. I said, I get to learn. What does that really mean? Which is a good thing, too, because as we working with our clients in terms of doing leisures and those who are getting their retirement is now giving me a whole different perspective. What does that really mean? I know from an intellectual standpoint what that's supposed to be. But now that I'm there, because there's no one to tell you how to do this. So I'm now starting to look at that from a different perspective now that I'm getting there. I'm talking to my mentors who have all retired and everything else. And I am talking to them and getting advice. Like I said, always. Now tell me, how did you guys retire? What do I need to do? They have given me some. First of all, make sure you have a plan. Make sure you have something to do it. I said, yeah, I got check. So I'm still getting advice from them for the next phase. How do we do this? But on top of that, I'm also the vice president for the OT Leaders and Legacy Society.
Okay.
We are a nonprofit group, and we are made up of those practitioners who are retiring or at that point that they don't want to work full time, but still want to give back to the OT profession and the community. And so we have different projects and different things that these OTs can work with. We're also using them and saying, asking them, will you mind being a mentor to the next generation? So I'm just kind of moving it over to the next level in terms of this is how we can help. I said, I've done my part in terms of getting things to this level. It's now up to the next generation. I said, I'm preparing leaders. And I tell my faculty and then tell my students, I'm preparing you to be the next leaders, not just OTs, the next leaders, not only of the profession, but everything else, because you guys are the ones now that will be in charge. We've got to this point. You now need to take it to the next point. Just like it was handed off to me, I need to make sure I can hand it off to the next generation.
Yeah, that's that servitude again, still coming through even into future retirement.
I know.
What can we do to?
Can't seem to get away.
What can we do to support? We didn't even talk about your books. I know you've authored or co-authored books. What can we do to support? I'm thinking one is purchasing your books and reading your books, but what else can we do to support you?
No, that that will help a lot, because it's a lot of the foundation in terms of especially how to start thinking about culture and how we approach people and what does that really mean. So the more people, because then people assume that this is all new. No, this has been around a long time. We've been talking about it. We've been doing things. We've been working on this. There are things that we've already tried. You and this generation have a tendency not to go back. You guys need to go back and understand the history. To see how we got here and what has already worked. And what the lessons we learned from them. And don't just jump in and think this is something new for you, because it is not true. I had to learn that and went back and talked to those folks. You know, when I first started, the first group I talked to was the Black OT Caucus. Okay, because you guys have been around longer. What are some of the issues and things that you guys have dealt with before I start to take this on? And saying, because I remember having those discussions with them and how, yeah, I understand you, but I want, and I remember asking them their permission. I want to give this a try. With what I want and what I think, because your upbringing, because they is very different from mine. You've been in a setting where there are a lot of Black OTs. I'm coming out here where the majority of the new African Americans coming from, we're the only one. We don't have that kind of a support system. So therefore, the issues and things that we are dealing with are totally different, and they need to become part of the conversation. So that was the piece I was able to bring to what they historically had already done. Now let me add, and so this next generation, and then on top of that is then we started to bring in practitioners with disability, and then making sure that all the other cultural groups, they all have a voice. So they need to have a voice. So it's really instrumental in getting those other groups started and saying, you guys need to be representative and put a voice in. So now we have all of these diverse groups. We're looking at all of these different issues. So the next step is next generation. Now, you guys got to take all of this and congeal it into one voice and say, where do we go?
Yes.
Yeah, they still talk to me, so I'm still advising them. And giving input to them and all the issues, and sometimes I'm like, please don't call me. But I know that because I told them I will always be there to help guide you and making sure you understand the history.
What's the name of the book?
It is Culture and Occupation.
Culture and Occupation.
Yeah. Cultural Effectiveness and Occupation in Practice, Education, and Community.
Awesome. And I'll put a link to this in the summary of this episode.
Okay, that's the third edition.
Okay. Anything else that you would like the audience to know? A quote that you want to leave us with, or just words of wisdom?
Follow your heart. It will not lead you down the wrong path. And it's not about the money. It's about what, can you sleep at night? Can you actually say at the end of the day, I help someone? Every day I start my day out saying, dear God, please give me the strength to help somebody. All I want to do is help somebody in some form, some fashion, and make the best decisions that I can. Because I don't know if they're going to be right or wrong. I don't get into that. I have to be able to help someone and give me the strength to make the best decision to help somebody else.
Wow. I think that's just an amazing way to start your day. And it just reminds me of, you know, it's more blessed to give than to receive. That if you are truly given, then you always have. Because it's not just about us.
Yes.
It's not just about us.
I'm able to pay my bills and I have a few little extra trinkets and I can travel, I can do things because I'm not running over, I don't have the big house, but what I have is comfortable and I can do some of the special things and I can donate and give back. What else is there about life than you can say? I change people's lives at the end of the day.
And that's a good note to end on. I am honored that you took the time out of your schedule to talk with us. I feel like I could talk to you all day long. I hope to meet you in person one day, but I really appreciate you sharing with us and being a leader, a pioneer in our profession, and look forward to hearing more about what you're going to do. Even up until your retirement. And that is our show for today. Don't forget to subscribe and tell others about this podcast. As always, I was truly inspired. Until next time, thanks for listening.